Welcome to the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. Laura Bailey is my guest this week. Laura lectures in English language and linguistics at the University of Kent. We talk about Newcastle. We talk about how the university culture has changed over the decades. We find out what Laura's earliest memory is. We find out how she especially enjoyed the process of writing itself. She had a penchant for undertaking creative activities from childhood. We talk about the peer pressure at secondary school in terms of learning about the latest songs. And we talk about the Princess Bride. We talk about going to university as a mature student, the role that fate and luck played in whether or not Laura was able to carry out a PhD. We find out about the inspirational teachers and the role they played in her life. An instructive conversation then unfolds about why several female academics added Doctor to their Twitter account name a few years ago. And at the end of the interview, Laura talks about whether she has fulfilled the dream she had when she was young and which decisions she wishes she had made differently. So join me. My name is Chris Deasy and Laura Bailey is the guest in the latest in my nostalgia interviews. Okay, well, I'm now with Laura Bailey, and these nostalgia interviews are a gathering track, so it's wonderful that you were keen to be, I say interviewed, but I kind of feel that they're really more conversations. Yeah, and you've been here at Kent how many years?
6 years.
Yeah, so but very new by the standards of some of the people I've interviewed and some of the people I want to interview, so that should be really good. So just give me a bit of a background, because obviously you work in English language and linguistics,
yes.
And perhaps give me a little sort of insight first about where you were before you came to Kent.
I came here, this is my first full-time academic position. I came here from Newcastle University, where I was doing my PhD, so I had about a month of overlap. My first month at Kent, that first September, was the last month before my submission date for my thesis, so that was hellish. But, you know, it was fine, got through it all. And so, yeah, I was in Newcastle before that, and I was there for my whole undergraduate, master's, PhD, because I actually already lived there. I lived there since I was 11.
Yeah. It sounds like me in the University of Wales. I only ever worked in one place before I came here in my early 30s. And so all my qualifications, everything, my whole everywhere I'd worked was effectively one institution. The title may have changed, but it was you know, the same part of West Wales.
Yeah, I had worked at in Newcastle, there's Northumbria as well, and I worked at both of them. Maybe done a couple of bits of work for other people, but and other non-academic jobs as well. But this was my first proper job, and I was 30, I think, when I came here.
Yeah, I like that idea of proper job, because I'm conscious that the only job I've ever done, and it was within a university, was stacking shelves in the university library, stocktaking, in 1995. So my CV, you know, is kind of geared.
Yeah.
There's one particular trajectory and not much else.
I had retail work on mine before my academic career.
No, but then again, I think when I was a student in the days, can you believe it, we had grants, and the only students who tended to work were those who, you know, obviously needed the money or just wanted something creative to do. But, you know, financially speaking, it was unusual for somebody to say, you know, I can't get through my studies without without a job. And these days, you know, it's the other way around completely. Students who say, I can't come in to my lectures because I have a job in London and I can't give it up.
I think I was still reasonably unusual in working about 20 hours a week during my degree, but that wasn't in a shop, actually. My retail work was before I came to uni. I did 3 years of full-time, proper, real-world jobs. But I did about 20 hours a week in a very nice job that I really liked, which is why I did so many hours. But I think I probably did more hours than most people did at their part-time job then. Whereas now I think that's quite normal.
Yeah, and I think the culture has changed. And of course, talking about nostalgia, there's a part of me that thinks, you know, what a wonderful student experience I had, because I was in a university where it was all campus-based and we didn't have the distractions of even a cinema, plenty of pubs. But, you know, and I sort of quite wistful about that. But then again, you know, that's easy for me to say, because I was a student 25 years ago. But students today will have their own set of experiences, which are far more sort of worldly wise, because then I look at students now and think, this is amazing. You know, they've got experience in all sorts of areas. You know, they're only 18 or 19, and they you know, even if it's a job in a supermarket, they have all sort of customer service skills, the sort of things that I only acquired, shall we say, you know, on the job, as it were, as an academic and through social student support work. So, yeah. So that's fascinating. Anyway, so you're from Newcastle. What about things like earliest memories? How far can you go back? What are the first things that you can remember doing?
I think the very first memory that, well, I don't know if it is my really earliest memory, but it's the first one that I can place it. So I know that I was 2.5 because it was when my sister was born. So obviously I know how old I was then. And I have a pretty clear memories of a couple of just flashes of things around then. So I remember, for example, the things that we, like the presents we took with us when we went to visit them in hospital. I remember seeing her in hospital, and, you know, just occasionally after that. And I also remember when my sister was a baby, because I can remember my mum holding her. My dad went off to try and sell our old car and came back with it because he couldn't sell it. But that was in Shrewsbury, which is where we lived when I was younger.
Oh, okay, so Newcastle wasn't where you were
born? No, we moved there when I was 11.
Yeah.
I was actually born in Stoke.
Oh, right, yeah. I got some family members up in, you know, that side of, you know, sort of on the border between Staffordshire and Shropshire. Yeah. And what about your parents? What did they do?
My dad was, well, in university management, really. He was dean of, I suppose it was probably humanities, I'm not sure what the faculty actually was called, but he was at Wolverhampton Poly, then Northumbria University, and then Leeds Met until he retired not that long ago, and now he does a lot of consultancy, and he's on the boards for various kind of digital media things and creative stuff going on. My mum's an artist, and has always done that, and she's also often done other jobs, so she's worked in some sort of admin role. She did the same job as me for a while, which was working in a very unusual job for the council, writing features for a talking newspaper. She currently does work for Yorkshire Museums, so she'll do things like archive a hoard of Roman coins or sew a Victorian outfit.
No, it's wonderful. I think also that sort of creativity sometimes. I find that, you know, with my parents, I think, well, where have I got, you know, particular attributes from, and, you know, sort of organisational or lack of in some, you know, sometimes I'm not perfect, but, you know, I sort of think, you know, I've got particular memories of growing up and my parents always being there, and this sort of like reliability, dependability. Like, my dad worked on the railway, so whenever I used to get the train, he'd always, in the days before apps, you know, he'd always know if the train was running late, or he understood that the network, and there was a sort of a level of, you know, confidence and a sort of, you know, security that came with. And you know, the older you get, you really do kind of feel, in my case certainly, I'm almost like turning into my parents. Mm-hmm. It only struck me the other day, because I'm 45, and I realised that my mum was 1 year older than I am now when I went to university, and that takes some adjusting, because there's a part of me that feels I'm still 18, but then again, she probably feels the same way. Yeah, so yeah, that sort of negotiation with our childhood past I find really inscrutable sometimes. But what about things that you enjoyed doing as a child? What comes to mind, whether maybe nursery or in school or during school holidays?
I don't know, really. I haven't thought about what did I enjoy. I suppose I quite liked creative things. So if you think right back to playgroup and nursery, yeah, it was, you know, I can remember making those, you know, those pictures you make by blowing through a straw into painted water?
Yes.
So I remember doing that, because all of the other children were sucked in, so yeah, it was disastrous. And writing. I liked learning to write and learning to read, actually. And I like school generally. And then, outside, there's lots of playing outside. We lived in this really nice, quiet, sort of a cul-de-sac kind of terrace, and so we could just play in the road with other children who lived nearby. And yeah, just had a big garden.
Yeah, and, you know, for me, I've got so many memories which are not necessarily helpful ones in terms of, you know, watching TV or listening to the radio, but sort of foundational experiences. But writing, I remember being at school where, when I was 4, we used to have what was called a diary, but the diary would consist of, this is a spider. I've moved on a little bit in my own diary writing since then. But, you know, all these sort of structures which I kind of really took to, and I loved reading Maths in my case was something that I struggled with a bit more, and I was useless at languages. Even though I was from Cardiff and we had to study Welsh,
I couldn't learn about, you know, whether I was good at languages or not until much later, because I didn't have to learn them when I was at primary school. But it was the, I mean, we used to like create magazines and things like that, you know, sort of writing, but it was more the process of writing that I liked. You know, I literally liked learning how to do handwriting and learning about different scripts and things like that.
Yeah, because there's that thing about goals, isn't there, that, you know, a PhD, obviously you've got a PhD, is a good example, where there's an objective to get it. You have to do it within a certain time frame. But once you've achieved it, rather than think job done, you kind of feel that you need to take something on in its place, and it might be another book. Or one of my PhD students said that, I think she was slightly joking, but she said that when she finished her PhD, she was either going to take up like knitting or even creative writing, but just something that would fill in that space, maybe different, but something that, you know, would also be creative but in a different way, rather than think, oh, job done, I can relax and do nothing, because that, for me, that's an alien concept. The concept of, you know, if I don't go to work, yes, I go to the cinema, but if I don't go to work as well, then my whole structure, the edifice of my life collapses. So, that's good. Now, one of the things that really was foundational for me, and you may have heard me talk about this in other interviews, but was music and growing up with the particular fashions at the time. And it's kind of funny with all the sort of like nostalgia-based radio programs like Sounds of the 80s now, and you think, did we really, you know, listen to this sort of thing? But for me, that was a massive thing in the playground with friends, and sort of comparing notes on what we liked, and it said something about our sort of our values, and you know who we identified with said a lot about our personalities and the different sort of directions that we were going in. Did you have any similar experiences?
Not until much later, not till I was a teenager, because when I was in primary school, and I think it must just have been because of, you know, my friends weren't into it, so nor was I just didn't listen to pop music at all, by which I mean contemporary pop music, just at all, until after I was 11. And so I listened to the things I liked, you know, what my parents had that I liked. So I liked the Beatles, and I liked Fats Waller and Miriam McCabe and things like that, and the Chieftains. And I think the only thing I bought myself then was a reggae, you know, one of these, the best, that's what I call reggae, or something like that, which I, that's still sort of nostalgic, those songs on there. But then when I was 11 and we moved to Newcastle, all the people that I met obviously were really into pop music, and I had no idea who anyone was or what they were talking about or anything, and was like, I just felt so left out and so stupid for not knowing what was going on and just so out of place. So, you know, I sort of swiftly had to decide who I liked and you know, what I was going to be into.
So there was a peer pressure element, or did you feel a need to catch up in order to...
I didn't have any friends. I thought, well, they all, you know, this is... I felt like I'd done it wrong, almost, for not, you know, not knowing anything about that stuff. It's like, how could I not? So then I started, you know, deliberately watching Top of the Pops and listening to things and that sort of thing, so that I could find out who people were and whatever. And I think the first thing I went for was Two Unlimited, which I don't know if you remember.
Is that the I Can't Get No Down?
Well,
is that
there? I'm not going to sing.
No, no, no.
Yes,
I might edit that out of myself.
But yeah. Some of the people listening will remember that, or it's widely available on the internet. And then, you know, I sort of settled into the things that I don't know whether I really like them, but, you know, what my friends and I liked, and so there were boy bands and things like that. And then when what you're talking about, you know, where it said something about you, was really the Britpop era, and you were either a Blur fan or an Oasis fan for some reason. And I actually liked both. And I can't now remember... I think we were Blur fans. I'm doing inverted quotation marks because I did like Oasis as well. But
Now, somebody asked me that question in the 90s, and they said, "Are you Blur or Oasis?" And I said, "Do you know what? This is what was going on in my head." And this, I don't know, this says something about some deep-seated eccentricity. I said, "Do you know what? It wasn't even my generation." And I said, "There are two songs I can't get out of my head. One was Air Supply. I think it was I'm All Out of Love. The other was." Oh, Sad Cafe, Every Day Hurts. And I thought, for some reason, I thought, you know, I was always living in like in a different generation's music. And my dad was hugely into like Buddy Holly, Lonnie Donegan, Everly Brothers. And
and they've become mine, and organically, you know, and I've never wanted to shake that. You know, for me, there's like twin growing up, you know, late 50s, early 60s, plus my own growing up in the 80s experiences. But I was really struck by what you just said about finding that your friends were into music that you'd never heard of, because although people associate me with film, before going to university, I really had very little interest. I mean, I went to a couple of films like Chariots of Fire, E.T. when I was younger, but no interest in it. But suddenly the structure of going, and, you know, I mean, reading a book is great. It can take weeks to get through a novel. But in a film, you've got 2 hours to sort of, you know, assimilate stuff and then process it and talk about it and review it. And so suddenly what I found that I wasn't just going to watch lots of new films, which I often do these days, but it was going back over the films that I missed out on first time round, or maybe saw on TV several years after the date. So it's almost like, you know, when I was at school, everyone was talking about Ferris Bueller's Day Off or Ghostbusters or Back to the Future, but I only discovered those films many years later. But it gave me like a double perspective. It was more, what were my friends thinking, what would they have been thinking when they saw this first time, and moreover, what was I doing instead? So they were all going to the cinema, and like, what was I doing, listening to the radio? So for me, it's really interesting to sort of see how, you know, we can't shake our own paths and our identities, but how they're so unbelievably forged by other people, which sounds like your experience.
I think I did a bit better with seeing films than listening to music, because I don't think I've ever felt like there was a massive gap, but there are certainly plenty of films that people my age absolutely love and I just didn't see, and I've caught up with most of those, and honestly, like, you had to be there.
You have to name some now.
Oh well, I don't know, what was the most recent one? The Princess Bride is rubbish, but everybody's so nostalgic for it, and I'm sure there were good reasons for that, and I did quite enjoy it. You know, it's a very enjoyable film, and it's, you know, got funny bits in it, but I didn't, you know, I think you had to be there.
I've never gotten the whole Star Wars thing, but I saw that once, and it's got Peter Falk in it, you know, Columbo, I think. And the only other thing I remember is it Carrie Elwes, who's an English actor, but often plays American films. But, you know, other than that, the whole mythology of it completely passed me by.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, so I suppose that series was ongoing when I was a kid, and I certainly didn't go and see those as a child, whichever ones were out, you know, late 80s or early 90s when I would have been expected to see them. I just didn't, and yeah, I'm not, you know, I've seen the new ones, they're fine, quite good, but it's not my sort of thing really. It's okay.
And for me these days, going to the cinema is something I really enjoy doing on my own, which is interesting because I find through social media, which we didn't have then, I can share those interests, and I've got friends and colleagues, and we can say, yeah, you know, have you seen so and so, and then, oh, based on that review, maybe I'll go and see it.
You do on Facebook what I really like doing in real life is that bit immediately after the film, like, what did you think? And you get that immediate post-film review, and then the next day you talk about it with people and you've thought about it a bit, but I like that immediate. And you do that on Facebook, I think.
I do, but for me it's a real struggle because if you ask me straight after a film what did you think, I feel I've just got nothing to say.
But
then I often read a review afterwards, and then I think, like Peter Bradshaw in The Guardian, I think, oh, I couldn't disagree more, and then that gives me the impetus to write the review, and often it's like, Peter Bradshaw says this, but I disagree. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I do it raw, but it's a good skill to have, but for me, that is so different to the rest of my academic writing, because I'm dealing with texts, resources that are there, and I'm incorporating them and assimilating them, and I'm dealing with secondary materials. Maybe these interviews are a bit different, because there's something very primary about them, but going to the cinema, there's a part of me that wants to recapture those primal experiences before they've been filtered by the critics.
You're
and so on.
You're very indiscriminate about what films you see as well. You just see everything regardless of whether it looks like it's going to be rubbish or not. Do you read the reviews before you go?
I used to. I feel I haven't got, because I go to the cinema so often, I just haven't got time so much, but I used to read all the reviews and often before the films as well, and it wouldn't deter me. I wouldn't not see a film because a film had a bad review, but it would be more of an incentive, like, you know, and I used to pick up on these inconsistencies, like Empire, when the film came to the cinema they might give a film 4 stars, but then on VHS 2 stars because it was reviewed by somebody else, and I think, well, you know, unless they're actually talking about the experience of watching it in the theatre, it just shows that it's all vague.
I think also random. Sometimes a film takes a while to find its, so I for whatever reason, I think maybe it was time when I was seeing a lot more films, so sometimes you did see slightly duff ones. I saw Van Helsing at the cinema with a friend, And we just laughed our way through it. It was so ridiculous. It just, you know, it was absolute nonsense, and got some dirty looks because there we were sniggering in the cinema. But then by the time it came out on DVD, it was a hilarious cult, you know, seemed to be classic or something. And we're like, no, hang on a minute. It was pitched as serious in the cinemas. They've redone the publicity on this to find a better audience. And I think it did all right on DVD.
Well, I think I was in touch with you on Facebook about A Bad Mom's Christmas, because, first of all, I was convinced that there was an apostrophe missing. And then you know, very well about apostrophes. I completely defer to you on that. But what was funny in that case is, first of all, I felt so embarrassed going over and asking for it, because, you know, man on his own, everyone went in groups. That was the thing. They were all lots of young, generationally, actually, they were young and old, but they were all mainly women. So I looked sort of, yeah, like I was from the wrong demographic, and I said, can I see A Bad Mom's Christmas? And I may have said it so quietly because I was slightly embarrassed, I had to repeat it. Yeah. And then and I thought, oh, it's for research, but thinking, well, yeah, I wrote a book on Christmas, but, you know, really. But what really struck me was halfway through the film, there were a group of young women in front of me, and one of them said something like, hey girls, let's have a selfie. But it was like almost like an extension of the film. It was like, it was that you couldn't have done that anywhere else. It was at the multiplex as well. But so no, you're right, I am terribly indiscriminate, but my music tastes are the same. But for me, it's not about the quality of something, it's the experience of it, and also it's almost like capturing a zeitgeist. And I think we all do that sort of in different ways. But what about entering academia then? So what made you either consciously or, you know, through happenstance enter this profession?
Mostly happenstance. Originally, I was going to go to university just like everybody else, just because it was, you know, I was clever at school, so obviously I was going to go to university. And then, for reasons, I decided not to go when I was 18, and took some time out and worked for 3 years. And I didn't think of it as time out. I was just like, no, I'm not going to go. I'm going to do something else instead. And 3 years of working in shops was enough for me to go, maybe I will go to university after all, if it means that I don't have to work in shops anymore, because I got very sick of it by that point. But when I reapplied age 21, I applied for the same course. Not necessarily the same institutions, but it was still linguistics. And that's what I'd chosen to do back when I was not even 18, you know, 17 or whatever you are when you first decide. And that was because I was lucky, really, because lots of people don't find linguistics when they should. So I did languages at school, and I liked them, but I didn't like reading literature in French. I liked learning French grammar. And I did French and Spanish and Italian at school, and it would just be good if someone had said to me, clearly you enjoy the grammar, linguistics is your thing, because you don't care about, oh, I like this language in particular, I just like languages. But fortunately, I happened across it by myself, partly because I was doing English language and I also liked that, but also because I read The Language Instinct by Steven Pinker, who unfortunately lately has said some questionable things, but nevertheless, The Language Instinct was the book that got me hooked and made me think that language was something worth studying, that you could study it. You know, you don't have to study literature, you don't have to study poetry, you know, it's language itself, and that it is interesting and fascinating and all of that. So when I went back, it was the same subject, and I just applied to Newcastle because I was like, oh, I need to stay in Newcastle, for terrible reasons, it turns out, but at the time, you know, they were good reasons for me. And yeah, so then there I was, which, I mean, that turned out it was a good thing, because Newcastle's a very good department. So I worked with some great people, and, you know, it's a great degree, and it was all, yeah, very good. But then the fact that I stayed in it became an academic, it was just chance. So I got my first, you know, I got a very high mark and was very pleased with it, but I was applying for jobs and I was applying for master's funding, and whichever one I got, I'd have taken. So I got the funding, so I did a master's. And then while I was doing that was a research master's, and it was very hard work, so I wasn't at all sure I wanted to go on and do a PhD. And my dad said, he thought, if you can do it, then you should. I don't know if that's really good advice, but that's what he told me anyway. And so I left it up to fate again. I said, well, if I get the funding, I'll do it, and if I don't, I won't. And I got it. Yeah. So I did it. And then once you're in a PhD, you sort of, you end up in academia unless you consciously decide not to, or you can't get it.
Well, there's almost a sense of being not unemployable, but you have such specialist skills.
Yes, exactly.
That, you know, to doing something completely different. Yeah.
And I did think about it, because, you know, we had talks from people who had a PhD and had gone on to do other things, and I thought, yeah, okay, I can see. If I wanted not to do this, I can see how I would sell myself. And I was thinking, right, what skills have I got? What conference organising have I done that I can be a conference organiser or something like that? But actually, by that point, I think I did want to do it. If I hadn't, I certainly wouldn't have been, because most people who end up in academia have gone through loads and loads of temporary jobs and done, you know, postdocs are all really interesting, but the stress of just 1 year contracts or 2 year contracts is so much. I wouldn't have done that, and I wouldn't have moved around the world for it. I might now, but at that time I wouldn't have done. So it was just luck that I got this job, which, yes, it was temporary, and it was temporary 3 consecutive times, but I didn't have to move, so it didn't feel as temporary. That was just luck.
And it's a curious profession, but I remember somebody once saying to me when I was in West Wales, they said, oh, well, if your department closed or you needed to leave for whatever reason, you could just move down the road to Swansea and do the same job there. It's like, well, no, because there isn't a department of theology or religious studies
quite.
There.
So I couldn't go to Christchurch and work there if I wanted to stay in this area.
So, which is why in this profession, particularly and peculiarly, you can go, you know, one moment you might be in West Wales, the next moment in East Kent or in Scotland or anywhere.
Yeah.
And in that sense, it's a little bit different. If you're a lawyer or a solicitor, then, you know, generally there are different and wider opportunities.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. No, and I, just struck by what you were saying about being a linguist, I learnt during my degree, because I was very lucky that I didn't have to do ancient Greek or Latin or Hebrew. Friends who did, you know, some of them were very competent at it, but I discovered after I got my degree, I thought, what do I do after my degree? Because my sister's a classicist, and she said, well, why don't you do the Greek and Latin summer school at Lampeter? And I did, and I realised I just got my degree. I did, you know, really well. I was so, you know, on top of the world, and I suddenly thought, why am I so incapable? You know, and I felt almost like this regression, like, you know, well, a moment ago I was writing these really good essays and now I just cannot understand basic language. You know, I didn't, you know, a verb, an adverb, you know, I was like, yes, I know, but it really struck me that I think we all in life, and it's a good thing, we often have skills. If we cultivate them, we can find, if we're in the right job at the right time, then everybody benefits. Mm-hmm. But outside of one's comfort zone, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, to this day I find that, you know, in the wrong place I really sort of start to come apart. So yeah, languages, I admire people like yourself who can do them.
Yeah.
Who can break down, you know, deconstruct literature, but yeah, it's not quite for me.
Yeah, I can't do with literature. Don't sell me skills I don't have. I can't do that. Yes, no, I actively chose to do Latin, but then when it came to saying what Ovid meant by this or that, I'm like, I'm sorry. I'm going to leave it there and go back to my grammar. Thank you.
Yeah. But it sounds like you probably had some really good inspirational teachers, maybe at school or indeed at university. I mean, what was it that made you stay? Obviously, you got a really good degree result. But do you put that down to particular teachers or lecturers, or, you know, or perhaps was it all down to your own initiative? Do you sort of think, well, you know, I did this in spite of, rather than just because of whomsoever might have been a particular formative influence?
I did have, you know, I was inspired by my teachers. So in my first year at university, you know, in my very first syntax lecture, you know, I remember sitting there and having this absolute, you know, mind-blown kind of experience. But I don't know if that was him as such, or simply that he just explained, he just showed me syntax and the world was suddenly opened. Maybe that could have been anyone, as long as they explained it well. And he certainly did explain it well. He was a very good teacher, and, you know, I then worked with him for many years after that. And, you know, he actually went to Kent in his first year.
Oh, but in the mid-60s.
Of Kent, he was here doing English literature. So he was very pleased when I said I was coming here. But yeah, so he inspired me in that sense. And then later on, the person who ended up being my PhD supervisor, interestingly, first year, I did not think anything of him at all, because he was so awful as a teacher in first year, for whatever reason. I don't really know why, but it just wasn't his thing. But then as I got more advanced, I could see that he was a brilliant linguist, and then he was also a brilliant PhD supervisor. He's such a good person, and such a, you know, like, exactly what you would want. And yeah, I had lots of other inspirational lectures as well. And then, yeah, earlier in my schooling as well, you know, I can sort of think of those teachers and go,
Were you inclined to go back and contact them afterwards and say, thanks to your brilliance, you know, I'm doing this now, or...
All my university lecturers know exactly what I'm doing, obviously. I haven't felt the need to go back to my school teachers. You know, I think maybe when I was younger, I did sort of think, like when I got a first, I thought, oh, perhaps I should go back and tell my teachers that I've done well. And it wasn't necessarily even the ones that inspired me, but more like, just to say, in your face, I did it, you know, to the ones that didn't think I was going to do it.
I had teachers who... I got the sense, maybe it's a misapprehension, but there was a part of me that, because I took a little while to find my feet, I always think that if I'd had the 11 plus had existed when I was at school, I don't think I would, well, I can't say that, but I don't think, certainly in terms of where I was put in secondary school, in terms of the streaming system, it took me a while to build up, and certainly by the time I reached GCSE, I sort of, you know, found my comfort zone. But there was a part of me that needed and did in fact go back, almost to sort of say, look, I could do this. So so hopefully now you have a different impression of me. I remember being with my dad in the supermarket. I just got my degree and I saw a history teacher and he said, oh, you know, well done, you've just got your degree, what are you going to do now? And I said, I'm doing an MA. He said, what in? I said, death and immortality. And he looked at me, he looked at my dad and was like, why on earth would you do that? And it was one of those really awkward moments, like, oh, okay. And he's like, right. And I was really quite surprised by that. But it was almost a sort of, I'd taken a very different path, perhaps to the one that I might have been expected to take in school. He taught me politics. It was a very sort of grounded subject. And maybe he thought I was going off into ethereal territory. But yeah. Did you ever have experiences like that? Anyone thinking, how did you do that?
No, not exactly like that. I just, when you said meeting someone in the supermarket, it just reminded me of when I worked in Waterstones. And just by coincidence, two former teachers were in the shop at the same time. And the one I was serving, the one I liked, and the one I hated was just behind him. And he said, oh, is there a discount for former teachers? And I said, oh, for ones I like, yeah. I thought, oh, gosh, I shouldn't have said that. I had the opposite experience to you. So I was always very good at school, and I would have absolutely aced the 11 plus, and, you know, it would all have been great. And I got good GCSEs, not the best in my year, but, you know, I didn't revise that hard, I don't think. And then in sixth form, I just almost on purpose just kind of messed up a bit and stopped going, and so really messed up my A-levels, like, massively so. And so it's that one teacher that, he wasn't even my teacher, but he was head of English language, and he was substituting for someone else one day or something like that. Anyway, he said, I very clearly remember him saying, I'm going to keep close eye on your mock results. And I was like, okay. And then I got very good mark in my mock results just despite him, and I still remember him, and I think, I wonder if, you know, he's still in the world of, you know, linguistics. And I think, well, I want to go back and tell him.
No, but it's funny, isn't it, how sometimes, and it could be family members as well, but there's almost a sense, a hurdle that you want to overcome, and you want to almost sort of say, well, I did it. I didn't think I could do it, but I did it. And now, you know, I'm excelling, you know, on a certain path, which I couldn't have imagined happening 20 years ago. And that need to almost want to advertise it. But it's not showing off. I think it's a real case of saying, look, you know, I achieved something that I didn't think I could do. And you kind of almost want just to sort of say to somebody, well, actually, in some way, big or small, you were part of that journey.
Yeah, exactly. And that all of my, you know, everyone who taught me at university and so on, you know, absolutely very grateful to. And people, yeah, who helped me along the way. Yeah. But even my primary school teacher, who was one of these people that just went beyond what he needed to do and would find extra things because he thought you'd be interested in them or something like that. So, yeah, he was great. Don't know what he's doing these days, but you're not on Twitter, are you?
I am on Twitter, but it's a very different medium to Facebook, and it's more about advertising sort of formal things rather than personal.
Not. You're doing Twitter wrong. You're welcome to use it like that, but that's not how you get pleasure from it. But no, recently there was, the reason I ask is because you mentioned showing off, and it very much is perceived as showing off by some people. So recently, a lot of female academics added doctor to their Twitter name, consciously. So I've never had it in mind, because why would you? It's Twitter, you don't need it, you know what I mean? Like, my Twitter name is Linguist Laura, because I tweet mostly about linguistic things, but it's not about my professional presence really, or needing to kind of maintain some sort of reputation or anything like that. It's very personal. So I've never had it. But recently, a woman, she's in history, I don't know where, but she does lots of public engagement stuff, but she's also a lecturer in history. And she was asked if it was Miss or Mrs., as we all often are, and said, "It's Doctor. I worked hard for this and I've earned it. My title is Doctor." And instantly, the men of the internet leapt in and told her she was showing off. She should be more modest. She shouldn't be so up herself. How dare she? Didn't she know that other people who don't have PhDs can also know stuff? And she was like, whoa, okay, this is, you know, hold back. I didn't say any of those things. And so about a zillion female academics all changed their name to Dr. So-and-so, including me, because it is perceived as showing off by a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah, I found this on Facebook because partly I wanted people that I went to university with or friends to want to engage with me. And I thought they may be put off if I start saying, well, I've got a PhD in this or whatever. But there's also the incongruity I sometimes feel, because on the one hand it says PhD in, you know, religion and film. And then, of course, it's like, here I am outside the multiplex where I've just seen the latest in, you know, campus comedy or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
It's really funny, isn't it, how sometimes there are these perceptions. But also, yeah, one thing that I think probably is the case with me is that I've somehow integrated a lot of different, often opposing sort of interests. Film-wise, yes, I've got a PhD in film, but that doesn't mean to say I only watch inverted commas highbrow or serious films. The PhD was certainly not suggesting that one should. So I've made a case for looking at a whole variety of different forms of entertainment. But yeah, I certainly find that social media gives me a voice which doesn't come through in the same way through, say, teaching, where, you know, if I wasn't teaching that module, somebody else would. So there's a sense in which I can be myself a bit more through social media. But no, that was really instructive about the way in which we use our titles to define who we are. Mm-hmm. But of course, when you see books, often from American, like counsellors or psychologists, that would be, you know, this is by Dr. John Brown, and it's almost then saying, well, therefore, this is obviously a work of great professional, you yes. know, certainty and excellence because of their qualifications. But often yes. you think, well, really, it's a bit
cases,
wishy-washy.
Actually, you have the exact sense of what this, her name is Fern, I don't know how you pronounce this, her name, Riddle, maybe. She got a lot of criticism along the lines of, if you need to say it, then you obviously aren't good enough, or you obviously aren't a real doctor if you need to say it. And that's the sense you get with those books, actually, isn't it? It's like, do you need to put doctor on your book cover to give you that, you know, authority? But she said, no, that's not the point. It's about that women especially are disproportionately criticised for saying, look, I'm an expert, I have the authority in this field.
Yeah, I sometimes don't know how to play it outside, because when I got my PhD, I wanted then to tell the bank and the electricity board, you know, to change my title on my bills, my utility bills. But at the same time, I remember just after I got my PhD, a Radio 2 presenter called Johnny Walker was taken off air. He was suspended due to some allegations that appeared in the press. And there was an online petition for him to be reinstated. And I signed this and said, yes, he should definitely come back. And I signed it, Dr. Chris Deasy. And my sister at the time said, I don't think you should have done that, because that's almost like saying that somehow your opinion is supposed to count for more because you've got a doctorate, when actually what you got your doctorate in has got nothing to do with why you think this presenter should be reinstated. Mm-hmm. And that was very lovely. But of course now I don't even, you know, I don't need to talk about it, because it's in a way, it's part of who I am. I've had the PhD so long, yeah. You know, in a way I don't need to say, hey, guess what my qualifications are.
Yeah, well, as I say, I don't ever, I mean, the only reason I use my title is because people ask me for a title. If they never did, I'd never tell them. Mm. But they ask me Miss or Mrs., and it's neither.
Yeah.
So
That's the wonderful thing. That's the one area, actually, when you've got a doctorate, that you don't have to worry about all those, often quite, you know, and they can be perceived to be quite offensive. You know, sometimes titles about whether you're Miss or Mrs. or Ms., you can just say, I'm Doctor. And in that sense, you don't have to give anything away about your marital or other.
Nor
should you, because I don't have to.
Exactly.
Yeah. What about other things at university? What about, were there anything to do with sports or politics or religion? Anything that you may have had an interest in that has sort of carried forward?
At university? No, I didn't do anything like that at university. Certainly not sports. You know, when I was younger, I did you know, tried various sort of sports, and now I dance, as you know. But at university, I didn't do anything. I didn't really have any extracurricular stuff at university. I just, yeah, I worked, as I say, and I, you know, I hung out with my friends, but I didn't particularly do anything. I played the cello at school, and I never carried it on at university because you had to be of a certain standard. You know, you had to have done grade 8 or something, and you know, to get into the orchestra. And I thought, no, I don't want something so formal. And also, I wasn't that, you know, I hadn't done grade 8 anyway. But yes, I just didn't do those kinds of things.
Yeah, and also nor, I think, should you have to, because, you know, sometimes you find your own level sometimes, you know, what works for you, rather than, in my case, I know that because I didn't have very many extracurricular activities and I was so not into sport, I learnt the piano, but it was a complete bind. I used to go to lessons every week. I didn't practice during the week. I just didn't like it. But there were things that I did have a passion for, radio, for example, which perhaps in, I should have cultivated, but didn't. Mm. And even to this day, I kind of regret that.
Yeah. Well, actually, I've just thought, I have always swum as a way of just unwinding. And I did do a lot of that while I was at university. I'm just, you know, it's just something that allows me to think by not thinking, if you know what I mean. Because you're in this place with nothing else to do, apart from, I count the lengths, but I can think while I count. So it's almost, I think it's the same sort of principle as meditation. I've never done meditation, but I think it's the same kind of thing. You think about not thinking.
But I'm doing a course on mindfulness at the moment. And for me, it's a bit of a struggle because, in a way, I've got all the time, I've got things from my past floating through my head, and sometimes I don't think it's necessarily destructive. It depends what they are, I suppose, but sometimes I find different ways. I write lots of things down. I write down my thoughts and I interrogate my own thoughts and do lots of comparing, contrasting and assimilating notes from 20 years ago, etc. But for me, that sense of being in like a pure mindful state, I struggle to do that. Even when I'm at the cinema, I've got lots of things going on in my head, but I kind of find that I'm just about able to balance all that out.
Yeah, no, I don't interrogate my thoughts, and I also don't find it easy to, you know, exactly as you say, to do that. But the swimming thing, as I say, it's the act of counting the lengths, because that forces you to concentrate on that. It's just enough concentration that I can think quite consciously on top of it, without all of the other things going on that are always there. You know, there's always millions of things.
Yeah, but it's interesting because those are skills that you can, I'm sure, apply to other facets of your life, academic, for example. I know for me, when I used to do things like write the charts down on a Sunday when I was growing up, that sense of structure that came to that, it may have been seen to be trivial, perhaps, to some people. But what I was doing, I had different colour pens for different, you know, whether a song was going up or down, or it was a re-entry or a new entry or a non-mover. And because of that, it gave me this wonderful sense of order and structure and also patience. And so rather than look back now and think, God, I wasted my Sunday evenings when I was 16, I look back and think, actually, that showed a real sort of sense of drive. But at the time, I think my parents were sort of, oh dear, you know, well, you can't do that when you're older. And I was thinking, but why not? But oddly, although I don't do that anymore,
you've shown them.
Yeah, yes, yeah. But I still remember those, and I always think that, you know, there will be one day when I'll be in a room and somebody will ask a question, and I'm the only one who'll know the answer. I'll know what was number two that week in 1984 or something.
Yeah,
and I think
having pub quiz.
Yeah, absolutely. So in a funny way, I kind of feel this is me trying to justify it to myself that it's not completely in vain. You know, they were worried about me then, but now they're just a little less worried about me. Just a few more questions. What about the sense of whether you feel you've fulfilled all the dreams that you might have had when you were young? Do you ever think, I wish I'd gone down that path rather than this path? Because for you, obviously, you didn't necessarily plan or expect to be an academic. It was largely down to whether you get the funding. But do you ever think, you know, I wish I'd been, you know, I'd chosen to do something else instead today?
Not really. But when I was little, you know, I wasn't one of these, you know, I've got a friend who, she always wanted to be a doctor, and now she's a doctor. So, you know, she's done well. I never was like that. I always picked different, you know, I wanted to be a sweet shop owner and an astronaut and a writer and all the rest of it. And one of those things was lecturer, because that's what my dad did when I was little. So I was like, yeah, I'm going to be a lecturer. So in that sense, I have done it. But I'm not, yeah, I wasn't so single-mindedly set on something that I think, oh, it's, I wish I had done that other thing. I sometimes wonder what it would be like to do, to have done something else, to have picked a different degree, to have done a different job, but it's out of interest rather than wistfulness. There are things that I wish I'd done in my life, like I wish I'd taken a year abroad during my undergraduate degree, for example. I wish I'd, you know, there's, you know, some personal life decisions that I think, oh, I wish I'd done that differently, but happy with my career path.
And I think what's also really nice, it's like the way in which we often have students who come here as mature students, is that, you know, not everything has to be set in stone. Mm-hmm. And you, I mean, inevitably, because I've been in this profession all my life, it's, you know, unthinkable in a way that I might be doing something other, because my track record shows that, you know, I clearly sort of belong here. But there's always a, you know, a part of me that thinks, you know, what if? And I think that's healthy, because it means we all have aspirations. I mean, you know, some people might think, I'd like to walk on the moon. If you never walk on the moon, you may not be disappointed, but at least it's the sense of, well, have ambitions. Yeah. Some realise, some not, but there may be things you can do that allow you to engage in, you know, space exploration, but without, you know, while staying on the ground, you know, through research, for example.
Yeah. And the other thing is that I quite like, in a sense, the way that you can track the things through your life that have led up to you being where you are now. Not in a sense of inevitability, because of course you could have done something different at any time and you can change things now, but just the way things are now, I'm pretty happy with my life as it is right now, and I'm here in this exact point, in this place, in this job, with the, you know, family and friends and relationships that I have, because of everything that's happened up till now. And anything different would not lead me to this point. So I can sort of track those things back and go, okay, so because of that, that happened. And then because of that other thing happened. And then that led to this. And so you can just trace that path through your life, which I quite like. It's just a nice exercise to do. Mm. And it means that even if there's something I wish I'd done differently, it doesn't matter. Yeah. Because I could have done it differently, but I didn't, and things are fine.
But are you in touch with, you know, friends from school or university who may or may not have realised their goals, but do you have a different relationship with them now that you're doing what you're doing? Are you still in touch with them? But how do you feel? Do you sort of feel that sense of continuity that if you go back and, you know, to Newcastle and you see the friends that you grew up with, do you find that you're able to go back and almost like return to those same conversations that you had, or do you feel that you've moved in a different direction, you have a different sort of network these days?
I mean, I don't, when I go back to Newcastle, I don't meet up with people I grew up with because they've all moved away, so we all went to, you know, different places to university and they're in those different places now. So I'm still friends with some of my school friends, and when I meet up, you know, with one friend in particular, yeah, we just chat away like we always have done. And even I've got a couple of friends from primary school who I almost never see, but when I do, we just, there's a few minutes awkwardness while you say, so what have you been doing for the last 10 years, but then we just chat away as, you know, like best friends. And yeah, university friends as well. I'm trying to think which of my friends are university friends. But yeah, I have lots of friends in Newcastle, and when I go back, yeah, they're all doing different things and things have worked out differently for lots of them. You know, one friend I met while I was doing my PhD, and he, in the end, didn't finish his PhD, and now is very happy doing an entirely different thing, becoming a teacher, and yeah, and it's just, yeah.
I find one of the things on Facebook that is quite surreal is that you might have friends you went to university with, maybe family members, people you have met in more recent times, people who have no, you know, academic background, and they often correspond, you know, on the same posts, and so you might say something and then you suddenly find that there's these two people engaging with each other's posts that are only connecting because of yourself, but at different stages of your life. You think, well, this person I see regularly, but that other person who they just engaged with is somebody I knew really well when I was 19 but have had no contact with in 25 years. And so it's almost like you are creating these new relationships,
well, one
new
of
friendships.
My most favorite things to do is to just get a bunch of people together that I think will probably get on well that don't know each other. So if I have, you know, a night out or something, I'll invite people from work and people from, you know, people I know in Norgate and people from wherever, because if I think they'll get on well, they probably will. And I just love that. I love when they do get on and then they make friends, and that's nice.
No, absolutely, because otherwise if you sort of said I have my academic friends and my school friends and my administrative colleague friends or my academic colleague friends or my, you know, it sounds a little bit forced, because in the real world people themselves of course have a whole variety of interests. You know, we're not all, you know, nobody would want to sort of put themselves in a particular box, and there are certainly plenty of colleagues of mine who I wouldn't want to necessarily
associate with. Put themselves in a particular box, and that's fine for them, but it's certainly not the way I would live my life.
Absolutely. Anyway, my very last question, which has had some a variety of answers from the respondents so far, but would you consider yourself a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I don't know. I do think about, you know, the things in the past. You know, it's not like I just go, oh no, that's past, it's happened, and you know, there's no point thinking about it anymore. You know, if I say something stupid, I will go over it a million times in my head and think, oh my god, that's so embarrassing, until, you know, years later no one else remembers but me. But and yeah, I like remembering nice things. You know, I always look at, you know, things that happened on this day on, you know, on my phone and stuff. I like doing that, and kind of remembering those nice things. But I'm also a big planner. Like, I love thinking about things. I love anticipating exciting things coming up. You know, I like making lists and arranging things and doing stuff, and yeah, I look forward to the future. So I don't know, if you're going to make me pick one, I'll pick looking forward. But yeah, in a, yeah, just because I like to be excited about the next thing.
Yeah, but often it's those past experiences and the things that you've done, the things that you've planned before, that make you plan the next thing in a different sort of way. So the two kind of overlap and coalesce. But but Laura, thank you, that was wonderful, that was really insightful. Thank you for being my guest this week.